Hello, this is Marcia Clenard with the Pantograph for Monday, February 17th, President's Day, as well as some readings from the newspapers for Saturday the 15th and Sunday the 16th. We'll start, however, with Monday, front page article, A Natural Fit. Dietz names assistant for diversity at Illinois State University. Illinois State University President Larry Dietz wants better collaboration and coordination and collaboration on diversity and inclusion issues and a strong voice to tell us what we're doing and need to be doing. So he has appointed Doris Houston to the newly created position of Assistant to the President for Diversity and Inclusion. Her duties will begin in July, and it will be considered an interim appointment for 2 years. Houston's salary will be $112,000, the same amount she is making in her current position as interim director of ISU School of Social Work. She has been with the School of Social Work since 2005. Dietz said there are a number of diversity initiatives across campus, many of which cross between student affairs and academic affairs. We've done a lot of diversity and inclusion, but it's been decentralized, said Dietz. Houston's job will include making sure people are aware of what others are doing and focusing on outcomes. She will serve as a liaison to the Diversity and Inclusion Advisory Council, which she currently chairs, and oversee systematic review of the Campus Climate Implementation Task Force. Part of her duties will be to see what other institutions do with similar positions and see what fits here. I know it's not a one-size-fits-all position, said Dietz. Illinois Wesleyan University recently named Hannah Musuani as Director of Office of Diversity and Inclusion. The ISU campus was the scene of protests on the quad and in social media last fall under the hashtag #AntiBlackISU. The claimed ISU was not living up to its commitment to diversity and inclusion. Dietz said the new position is broader and deeper than the protest and part of an ongoing dialogue that included a campus climate assessment that resulted in several recommendations. He added, "Of course we listen to students and faculty all the time." In his first State of the University address as president in 2014, Dietz talked about diversity and invited people to talk to him about it. "Houston was the first person who came to my office," said Dietz. "Since then, she's been really leading the charge on diversity and inclusion." In addition to her leadership on the Diversity and Inclusion Advisory Council, she was one of the leaders of the steering committee for the recent Campus Climate Task Force. Houston said her new role is a natural fit with her background in social work. "Social justice, equality, and inclusion are at the core of our discipline," she said. "Strong advocacy is at the core of what we do." With the demographic shift that is leading to more students from underrepresented groups enrolling at ISU and other institutions, Dietz said, it is important to ensure the services offered are meeting their needs. He said people need to be aware of that issue, listen closely to people, develop a plan around that, and work the plan. One example is the planned multicultural center that was among recommendations that followed the campus climate assessment. Dietz said he will present a request at Friday's Board of Trustees meeting for approval to start renovation of the building at Main and Dry Grove Streets that will become the multicultural center. The goal is to have the building, currently the Instructional Technology and Development Center, open as the Multicultural Center this fall. And now to another story on the front page of today's or Monday's Pantograph. Zoning variants could be catalysts for change in normal student housing. The Normal City Council will hear a zoning variance matter on Monday night that the mayor hopes will be a catalyst to upgrade student housing in the area. The council meeting will begin at 7 p.m. Monday at Uptown Station with a public hearing regarding the zoning variance. The council is scheduled to vote on the matter later during the meeting. The property owner of 105, 107, and 111 West Locust Street, Normal, is proposing to replace those student apartment buildings with a five-story, student-oriented apartment complex. It's an area that has some of the oldest student housing in the community, Mayor Chris Coos told the Pantograph on Friday. The fact they're upgrading to a modern facility could be a catalyst for some change in the area, he said. The Iden family, which has owned the buildings for many years, is proposing to redevelop the properties into one building with a circle drive in the front to facilitate ride-hailing and delivery services. Their recommended plan requires one zoning variance for parking for 11 fewer vehicles than required by code and a setback variance for 5 feet less than code requires in the rear yard. The variances were reviewed at a public hearing before the Normal Zoning Board of Appeals on January 28th. While the board voted 3-3 to deny the variances, a zoning board member later said his vote against the variances had been an error, so the vote should have been 4-2 in support. As a result, the property owners appealed to the city council. Town staff supports the recommended plan in its report to the council. First, more people are using ride hailing, such as Lyft and Uber, and delivery services such as by Amazon and grocery stores, city manager Pam Reese said. That's why they're proposing a circle drive, she said. The property is a good opportunity to see how these trends are playing out in Normal and may entice students to forgo bringing their cars to campus. In addition, the proposed building setback would result in better landscaping, and the proposed building itself should last decades, town staff said. Reese said the property owner hopes to open the new building by fall of 2021. Reese added that the area has a history of flooding, and the Iden project may help to improve the situation because the project would be required by code to provide on-site stormwater detention. But, she said, the flooding covers a larger area, and the town's Public Works Department has solicited proposals from engineering firms to do a larger flood study. In other business, the council will take up several resolutions, including appropriating $379,100 of motor fuel tax money to repair the Towanda Avenue Bridge over Sugar Creek, appropriating $405,750 of motor fuel tax money to replace the top part of the Gregory Street culvert over Sugar Creek and to make related improvements. Authorizing an increase in Reese's annual base pay by $5,550 from $185,000 to $190,550 retroactive to April 1st, 2019, the start of the current fiscal year, following a recent performance review. Moving now to the papers for the weekend, these are a few articles from Saturday's Pantograph, February 15th, 2020. Seniors pitch in, volunteers making former Casey's an activity center. The old Casey's store had already become a gathering place for senior citizens, even though its conversion to a seniors activity center had barely begun. People in the community are looking forward to, said Evelyn Johnson of Leroy. Many of the community's seniors have been showing up at the building at 209 West Washington Street to help any way they can with the project, sweeping, removing shelves, and breaking down walls. We're all going to pitch in and work in here to get this place going, said Judy O'Neill of Leroy. I like to tear things apart, said Carol Pfaff of Saybrook, whose husband Kevin also is helping on the project. Barb Whiteman of Aerosmith is the dynamo behind the project with her nonprofit organization, Living Well United. Whiteman has been teaching a Silver Sneaker senior fitness class at Leroy's Replex for almost 6 years. Recognizing the need for no more social interactions, he started adding other activities. A senior center seemed like the next natural progression, she said. No opening date has been set. It will depend on when work is completed on such things as installing two accessible bathrooms that meet the requirements of the American Disabilities Act, she said. Whiteman first approached Casey's about donating the building when the store closed in 2017. In January, her dream came true when Casey's gifted the building and property in exchange for payment of about $6,000 in taxes on the property. So far, most of the money has come from Whiteman's pocket, but she is applying for grants and willingly accepts donations to Living Well United, a 201(3) nonprofit organization. She can be reached at livingwellunited@gmail.com. If this is someone's mission, we'd like to have them join us financially, she said. All the work so far has been done by volunteers, said Whiteman. That includes architect Lori Johnson of Jade Architecture Farmer City and general contractor Aaron Hanslow of AMH Home Improvements Farmer City. Lori Johnson, whose mother Evelyn is part of the exercise group, said the biggest challenge has been getting Barb to slow down to a normal person's pace. Evelyn Johnson said Barb makes people enthusiastic about everything. Her energy comes through everybody. The exercise group already seems like one big family, and laughter came readily and frequently at a recent gathering at the future site of the senior center. Our group is good for that, said Jerry Roberts of Downs, triggering more laughter when the 87-year-old said he is looking forward to getting my abs in shape. That prompted Forrest DeVore of Leroy to ask, if 60 is the new 40, what's 87? Whiteman said there are 2,000 senior citizens in Leroy and surrounding small towns. They are active here in the community. They have so much to give. She is hoping to have intergenerational activities with students from nearby schools, as well as educational and social activities for seniors. No age range has been set yet. An advisory council of seniors will help determine programming. Irma Crosby of Leroy is looking forward to informal activities like playing cards and having lunch together. O'Neill said it will be nice to have a place to gather where they are not going to be rushed to leave. And Rosemary Parker of Leroy said the center also gives us a way to check on each other. She said, everyone is so friendly and welcoming in our exercise group. Everybody cares about each other. Another article on the front page of Saturday's edition of the Pantograph, Public Safety. Teachers' Sex Abuse Counts Challenged. An attorney for Jonathan Hovey is seeking the dismissal of two sexual abuse charges filed against the former McLean County Unit 5 first grade teacher because he said the allegations are 14 years old and some evidence no longer exists. Hovey pleaded not guilty to all of the charges in August. On Friday, Judge Scott Drazewski set a hearing for 2:30 p.m. March 23rd on the motion filed in McLean County Circuit Court by defense attorney Tristan Bullington on Thursday. The state was given until March 13th to file a written response. The charges have created substantial prejudice against the defendant because a recording of an initial interview in 2005 with the victim has been destroyed, said Bullington in his motion. A delay of 14 years without any justification is not reasonable. As a result, defendant has established both substantial prejudice and an unreasonable delay, Bullington also contended. The two counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse allege crimes between August 1st of 2004 and May 31st, 2005 involving a student. Conduct alleged in those two charges was investigated in 2005 and no charges were brought at that time. Hovey 37 of Forsyth also faces a separate trial on two counts of predatory criminal sexual assault, both Class X felonies, and two counts of aggravated sexual abuse, Class 2, that are alleged to have occurred between August 1, 2017 and May 31, 2018, with another student. As part of the original investigation, the alleged victim was interviewed by the Child Advocacy Center on October 13, 2005, and a recording of that interview was made, the motion stated. On November 7, 2005, the case against Mr. Hovey was closed, with the police determining there is no evidence to support criminal charges of Mr. Hovey. At some unknown point, the recording of the victim's interview was destroyed, Bullington stated in the motion. The Department of Children and Family Services also did an investigation in 2005, which it closed that same year as unfounded, according to the motion. All of the DCFS records from that investigation have been expunged from their records, according to the motion. Police interviewed the victim on July 8, 2019. Actual prejudice against the defendant exists here where statements made by the alleged victim that did not support the bringing of charges against the defendant have been destroyed, said Bullington in his motion. No efforts were made by the state to bring charges against the defendant between November 7, 2005 and April of 2019. From Saturday, February 15th, the lead article in the local section, Lincoln Paper Given to Museum. The McLean County Museum of History announced Friday the donation of an invaluable Abraham Lincoln document by retired Bloomington attorney and Lincoln scholar Guy Fraker. The legal pleading, running 1.5 pages in Lincoln's own hand, dates to the fall of 1851 and offers a fascinating window into the 16th president's law career and his deep connection to McLean County, said the museum in a statement. The museum is timing the announcement of the gift to the week of Lincoln's birthday on February 12th. On Saturday, the museum will unveil the document in a public program beginning at 11 a.m. in the museum's Governor Pfeiffer courtroom. Fraker and museum librarian Bill Kemp will offer an overview of the document before it is made public. The event is free and open to the public. In the pleading, Lincoln summarizes the claims of his client, Robert H. Rutledge, regarding an aborted real estate deal involving 160 acres on the southern edge of Downs Township in McLean County. At issue was neighboring landowners Jesse Funk's demand that Rutledge honor an alleged contract to sell the acreage. The case would conclude 2 years later when the McLean County Circuit Court ordered Rutledge to sell 80 of the 160 acres in question. Prior to Fraker's acquisition of the pleading and his subsequent research, historians were unaware of court case Funk versus Rutledge. That's not surprising, given that many of McLean County Circuit Court records from Lincoln's era were lost in the Great Bloomington Fire of 1900, according to the statement. The note, donated pleading is fascinating on many levels, said Fraker. It not only speaks powerfully to Lincoln's ties to McLean County, it says a lot about the importance of land in 19th century Illinois. This case is also interesting because Rutledge was cousin to Anne Rutledge of New Salem, who, legend has it, was Lincoln's first and truest love, he said. The document was acquired by Fraker in 2008 from Marilyn Townley, widow of Judge Wayne Townley Jr. His father, Wayne Sr., also a Bloomington attorney, had acquired the pleading well before World War II. Wayne Townley Sr. was a Lincoln collector and scholar in his own right. Fraker, a longtime supporter of the not-for-profit museum, said he could think of no better caretaker of this historically invaluable document. We'll now move to the front page of Sunday's paper, February 16th. And a front page item, another public safety item, police cameras cover city streets. When Bloomington police were called in May 2017 to the scene of a brutal stabbing death at a Westside motel, supervisors immediately began reviewing video footage from department-issued cameras to find out who killed 27-year-old Shannon Hastings. That footage eventually revealed evidence that helped convict Kyle Breston in December 2019. A public safety camera produced evidence in the case and led us to evidence in the case we wouldn't have had at all. That was critical in that homicide case, said Jack McQueen, who supervises the Bloomington Police Department's Crime and Intelligence Analysis Unit. Police said Bloomington's network of cameras, which spreads throughout the city in public areas, has provided a valuable view of the city and helped officials solve crimes and get convictions. But the use of cameras has also raised questions about privacy and how far the program will go. BPD currently uses 8 mounted cameras and 2 tote camera units that have generated evidence in 29 shootings, 7 robberies, 4 stabbings, 4 gun arrests, and 3 homicides as of mid-January. They have paid dividends over and over again, especially in regard to violent crime, McQueen said. The most recent camera installation was placed near the intersection of Howard and West Market Streets, though the equipment isn't kept in one place for longer than a few months. I think it's going to help out tremendously, said Paige Hinthorn, general manager of Metro by T-Mobile, 1001 West Market Street. There are lots of problems happening on this side of town, so I think it's going to help with the store's security. The cameras have been in use since 2013 and are deployed based on complaints and analysis of police reports, incidents, and calls for service. Our goal is to add 5 to 7 cameras per year for the next few years and see where that takes us. We don't want cameras on every other block. We don't want that. We think that's too much, said Police Chief Dan Donath. We don't want cameras on top of cameras. Of the 8 mounted cameras and 2 towed camera units, a few are currently down for repairs or updates. One previously at Market and Howard is now on Market just west of Howard. Others are at Tracy Drive at Oak Street, the 1200 block of Orchard Road, Washington Street at Lee Street, Euclid Avenue at Olive Street, and South Morris Street at Six Points Road. McQueen said the cameras are moved based on need and crime analysis. Police agencies around the world have turned to the devices as the technology has become more portable and less expensive. Chicago installed remote-controlled video camera in high-crime areas in July of 2003. Newark, New Jersey had cameras posted around the city and posts live footage online in hopes people will call in tips. But privacy groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, have raised concerns about whether the technology is too pervasive. One specific area of concern is the use of facial recognition software. Bloomington officials say the use of the technology clearly is having an impact. We find over the course of time that in order to solve some crimes, an interdispersing of cameras throughout the city does have value, Donas said. The Bloomington chief said cameras not only help the department reduce crime, but also help to reduce the fear of crime. Gary Muhammad, a barber at A Cut Above at the corner of Howard and Marcus Streets, assumes a camera was placed near that intersection because there have been a few minor things happening in the area over the years. But I would say that nowadays things have calmed down considerably. Whether the cameras had been a part of that, I don't know, he said. McQueen believes the cameras deter planned crimes and can capture evidence for spontaneous and often more violent crimes. The key to the program is transparency, he said. Nobody shouldn't know how it works, and nobody shouldn't know what they're collecting, and any problems that people have with it, we want to address on the front end of it, he said. Bloomington police said that when a camera is installed in a new area, the department contacts nearby residents and businesses to field any questions. But Muhammad said no one approached A Cut Above, although he believes the installation is good for the area. Probably all in all, it's a good thing the cameras are there, he said. If it's a measure to prevent crime or whatever, make the community more safe, then who can oppose being kept more secure? After a Facebook post about the cameras went up in January, the department engaged more with the community about the cameras and gave more details, including cameras are marked with the BPD logos and the word police. Cameras are deployed exclusively in public locations. Cameras are not actively monitored. Unless recorded footage is retained for criminal incidents, recordings are automatically deleted after 14 days. Cameras do not record audio. Use of footage is governed by state and federal legislation as well as an internal BPD policy. The main concern relayed to the department is privacy. What do these cameras see? In addition to pointing away from residential areas and instead toward roads, our newest deployments, as we're switching them out, have the ability to mask out private areas. Some of them have the ability to mask out your address, your windows, a door, a pool, for example, and when a camera moves, the mask adjusts with the image. An opaque box stays on the image. The technology just got there to allow that. Maintaining a reasonable expectation of privacy for residents is a priority. If we arrest you, we can't just go through your phone. It's going to be the same principles, the same reasonableness with any footage, said Public Information Officer John Furman. If the camera picks it up, even if we have access to that, we have to have a conservative approach, and that's why we're being transparent about it. When it comes to privacy, Muhammad said, we're under observation no matter where we are, uptown, downtown, east side, west side. If you're not doing anything wrong, what do you care where there's a camera? As cameras improve in resolution and capability, a new management system will help to keep police access conservative as well, McQueen said. We can lock employees out on a Zoom camera. Let's say it zooms 30 times, we can lock them at 15 so they can't go any further, he said. McQueen said the department has received only one complaint about the cameras since the program began. In the absence of complaints, we still want to be a good steward of public privacy as this program goes forward, McQueen said. You don't want to lose trust in the department at any point in time. In Normal, Police Chief Rick Bleicher said his department has researched the use of cameras and even borrowed them from BPD after crime sprees. But we don't have a plan to get a program in at this time. And that will end our first part. This is Marcia Clenard, and we'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the Pantograph for Monday, February 17th, President's Day. Please stay tuned.